Ever wonder if those pheromone perfumes actually work? It's a question that fascinates me because the science behind it is so complex. This whole idea of invisible chemical signals influencing our behavior, it's like something out of science fiction.
It really is. And what's particularly interesting to me is the debate around whether humans even have the necessary biological machinery to detect pheromones. We know they play a huge role in the animal kingdom, but with humans, it's still a bit of a mystery, right?
Exactly. So today we're diving into the world of pheromones and their potential role in human behavior. Do we actually respond to these chemical cues? And if so, how do they affect our emotions, our attraction to others, even our social interactions?
I mean, think about it. If we do respond to pheromones, it kind of adds another layer to how we understand human connection, doesn't it? It's a pretty profound concept.
Absolutely. It raises so many questions. Like, if pheromones are real in humans, how much of our behavior is actually driven by these subconscious signals? Are we more like moths to a flame than we realize?
Yeah. And think about the implications for things like mate selection. Is it all about personality and physical appearance, or is there this invisible chemical hand guiding us too?
It's a fascinating area of research, and there's still a lot we don't know. But one thing's for sure, the science of pheromones has the potential to completely change how we view human behavior.
I think a good starting point would be to clarify what pheromones actually are. I mean, the term gets thrown around a lot, but what's the scientific definition?
Well, pheromones are basically chemical signals released by an organism that trigger a social response in members of the same species. So think about like ants following a pheromone trail to a food source, or moths using sex pheromones to attract mates. It's all about communication, but on a chemical level.
So it's communication, but not in a way we consciously perceive, right? It's more like an instinctual response.
Exactly. And that's what makes it so intriguing. We may be influenced by these chemical messages without even knowing it. And the range of responses they trigger can be quite diverse, from aggregation, where individuals gather together, to alarm signals in the face of danger, even to marking territory.
It's incredible how much complexity there is in these chemical signals, especially in insects. The Wikipedia article mentions how some ants even use repellent pheromones to mark trails that don't lead to food. It's like a chemical wrong way sign.
Yeah. It's remarkable. And it's not just insects. Many other organisms use pheromones, including some vertebrates, plants, and even microorganisms. It's a communication strategy that's evolved across a wide range of life forms.
So, given this widespread use in the animal kingdom, it seems almost counterintuitive that humans wouldn't have some form of pheromone communication, right? But the research is still so inconclusive.
Yeah, and that's where the vomer nasal organ, or VNO, comes into play. It's this small structure in the nasal cavity that's thought to be involved in detecting pheromones in many animals. But whether humans has a functional VNO is a big part of the debate.
Right, and even if we do have a VNO, there's the question of whether it's actually connected to the brain in a way that would allow us to process pheromone signals. The neural pathways are crucial, yeah?
Absolutely. So we'll be exploring the evidence for and against a functional human VNO and the research into potential human pheromones, like anostedinone and those copulins you find in vaginal secretions.
And I'm particularly interested in the evolutionary perspective. If pheromones do play a role in human behavior, how did that evolve? And what purpose does it serve, in terms of survival and reproduction?
Those are excellent questions. And we'll also be looking at the ethical considerations surrounding human pheromone research and the rather dubious claims made by some of those pheromone product manufacturers.
Yeah, I think it's important to separate the science from the marketing hype. There's a lot of pseudoscience out there when it comes to pheromones.
So we were talking about the vomer nasal organ, the VNO, and its role in pheromone detection. It's really the crux of the matter when it comes to humans, isn't it?
It is, because even if we produce pheromones, if we don't have a functioning VNO to detect them, then the whole communication system breaks down, right?
Precisely. And the evidence for a functional VNO in humans is, well, let's just say it's controversial. Some studies suggest its presence, while others claim it disappears during fetal development. It's a bit of a scientific tug of war.
Yeah, and even if some remnant of the VNO does exist in adults, the bigger question is whether it's actually connected to the brain. Are there neural pathways that allow us to process these signals? That's the key, I think.
Exactly. And then there's the genetic aspect. Some of the key genes involved in VNO function in other mammals, they appear to be non-functional in humans. Pseudogenes, they call them. It's like having a light switch with no wiring.
So it seems like the biological machinery might be lacking, to say the least. But what about the behavioral evidence? I mean, there are studies that suggest humans do respond to certain chemical cues, right? Yeah.
There are. Studies on androstenedione found in male sweat and copulins in vaginal secretions have shown some intriguing results, like influencing mood and altering hormone levels. The effects are subtle and not always consistent across studies. It makes interpretation tricky, you know?
It does. It's hard to isolate these chemical effects from all the other factors that influence human behavior, like visual cues, social context, you know, all that stuff. It's a messy picture.
It really is. And I think that's why it's so important to be cautious about those pheromone perfumes and attraction sprays. Mm-hmm. The marketing often makes grand claims that, frankly, aren't supported by the current scientific evidence.
Yeah, the marketing hype definitely outpaces the science in this area. It preys on our, our primal desire to understand and control attraction. It's understandable, but it can also be misleading.
So we were talking about the vomeronasal organ, that elusive little structure in the nose, and whether it actually functions in humans. It's a bit of a scientific enigma, wouldn't you say?
It really is. We've got these tantalizing hints that it might play a role in our behavior, but the biological evidence is, well, it's a mixed bag, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, some studies, like the one by Trottier and Doving, actually show the VNO exists in a significant portion of the population. They even managed to visualize it endoscopically. But then you've got other research suggesting the genes responsible for VNO function are basically inactive in humans. So it's like, is it there but just not working? It's confusing.
It is. And then there's Potocki's 1891 paper, which you brought up earlier. He was so convinced of its presence and even speculated about its role in certain nasal septum lesions. It's fascinating how long this debate has been going on.
It really is. It's like we've been going back and forth for centuries. Even Jacobson himself, the guy whose name is synonymous with the organ, was hesitant to confirm its presence in humans. But think about those rare cases of ectopic esthesioneuroblastoma developing in near Jacobson's duct. That seems to suggest something is there, right? Some sort of residual tissue, maybe?
That's a compelling point. And the fact that the VNO seems to be more prevalent in children also raises questions. Does it regress as we age, or does its function simply diminish over time? We don't really have clear answers, do we?
No, we don't. And what about the behavioral studies? I mean, there are studies showing that exposure to certain chemicals like androstenedione can influence mood and hormone levels. Could that be evidence of a rudimentary VNO at work, even if we don't consciously perceive it?
Possibly. But it's so difficult to isolate those chemical effects from all the other factors that influence human behavior. It's a real challenge to design studies that definitively prove or disprove the VNO's role.
It is. And then there's the ethical dimension. If we do have a functioning VNO, what are the implications for things like manipulating human behavior through pheromones? It's a bit of a Pandora's box, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important to be skeptical of those pheromone products on the market. The science just isn't there to support the claims they make. It's crucial to separate the legitimate research from the marketing hype.
So this Potocki paper from 1891, it's remarkable how meticulous he was in his anatomical investigations of the vomeronasal organ, or Jacobson's canal, as he calls it. Really digging into the nitty-gritty details of its location and dimensions.
Yeah, his descriptions are incredibly precise, almost painstaking, like that rhombic search area he defines on the nasal septum.
Mm.
He uses Kolliker's measurements to pinpoint where the VNO's orifice is most likely to be found. It's quite a feat, considering the tools he had available.
It is. He even acknowledges the limitations of those measurements, pointing out that Kolliker only studied 18 subjects. He anticipates that future research will expand that search area, which it certainly has.
And I found his observations about the challenges of examining the VNO in living subjects fascinating. The lighting, the angle of the mucosa, the mucus and debris obscuring the view, he clearly understood the difficulties involved.
He did. And he offers practical solutions too, like using a wool tampon to gently clear away the mucus. He even specifies the ideal thickness of the stylet for probing the canal. It's very hands-on, very practical advice.
Yeah, and he emphasizes the importance of using a fine stylet, not just any old one, around 0.6 of a millimeter, he says. It highlights how delicate this structure is and how easily it could be missed.
Absolutely. And then there's his discussion of the VNO's potential role in nasal septum lesions. He really pushes back against the prevailing view that it's pathologically insignificant. He strongly suspects it plays a role, particularly in perforations of the cartilaginous septum.
He does. He even draws parallels with appendicitis, arguing that just because an organ is vestigial, like the appendix or the VNO, doesn't mean it can't be affected by disease. It's a compelling argument.
It is. He points out that the area where the VNO is located is also a hot spot for various lesions, like syphilitic ulcers and lupus. He wonders if the VNO's presence might somehow attract or fix these processes in that specific region.
And his discussion of Hajek's theory about the perforating ulcer is particularly interesting. He suggests that the VNO, as a cul-de-sac without any use, might be a breeding ground for the bacteria Hajek implicates in the ulcer's development.
Yeah, it's a thought-provoking idea. And he even coins the term Jacobson's ascites to describe potential inflammation of the VNO, though he admits he hasn't definitively observed it. It shows how forward-thinking he was.
It does. It's a shame he couldn't confirm his suspicions with the technology available at the time. But his observations laid the groundwork for future research and continue to inform our understanding of this enigmatic organ.